Hey, my name is Xenu, and you're listening to Anti-Moonboy News. We got a great show for you guys today. We're going to be talking about yet another attack on hardware cold storage wallets. Not one, but two. Both Trezor and SafePal were hit, and a lot of data from customers is out there. Oh boy. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to give a little update on BIP 110. As well as some other news. And we're going to have a book review. I'm going to be talking about The Reign of Botnets by David Senecal, which I read recently in preparation for my upcoming third interview for the Dot Files. So we're going to be talking about that as well. If you like the content, please consider subscribing and leaving me a like or a comment. You know the deal. Let's get to it. So yeah, the last few weeks have been pretty awful for the hardware wallet supporters. Of course, ColdCard had one of the most catastrophic exploits in Bitcoin's history, maybe the most, where many wallets, cold storage wallets holding Bitcoin were raided due to a bad random number generator. There's a lot of debate as to what was the cause of it. Some even have gone down the rabbit hole of thinking it's a conspiracy. But based on all available information, it just looks like they were incompetent. It looks pretty bad. And so anyways, it's been, you know, a week or two of making fun of them. Also feeling bad, obviously, for the customers who were affected. But yeah, the cold card guys, they were assholes, at least the main guy, NVK, and he's being dragged through the mud, rightly so, because this is just really unbelievable. But it gets worse, though, because now we have two other services that have also gotten exploited. Now, the good news is this isn't as bad, arguably, as the random number generator incident, but it's bad in a different way, a potentially violent way. Because for Trezor and SafePal here, they were essentially hacked, and in different ways. We'll go over each one. And because of that, customer information is now available on the dark net. Meaning, if somebody, you know, gets a, you know, a list of all these different people, they will know that they have a hardware wallet somewhere hidden in their home. Meaning, they can go and potentially wrench attack them. Of course, a wrench attack is from the $5 wrench way of breaking a password. You can have the most brutal encryption of all time to prevent a brute force attack, except if that brute force is literal. And if you use a wrench, you can beat the crap out of somebody until they, you know, acquiesce and give you the password. And this has been a huge issue, especially in France. I've been seeing a lot. And it's been an issue really everywhere. In the United States, there's stories every so often where people are being tortured because they have crypto. And it's pretty bad. Pretty bad. And why we recommend having good OPSEC, avoiding KYC if you can, and you know, minimizing the exposure of data that you're putting out there because of incidents such as a wrench attack. There's actually a story here. This is from a story in France, and basically a couple had moved into a home, and the home was previously owned by a crypto millionaire, and I guess his information was leaked on the internet as part of this hack on the French government. Yeah, I think it was like their tax records and everything. So basically, their house was broken into not once, not twice, but three times. yeah, by people who are trying to wrench attack him. Here we go. This is the first time the couple had bought the house 2 years earlier. The first group broke into the property June 24th, but fled after being frightened by the family dogs. 2 days later, another group got inside the home. During the second intrusion, one of the victims was tied up while the other was beaten. The assault was reportedly filmed live on Snapchat, which is, let me pause right there. Why were they filming this on Snapchat? That's fucking insane. Anyways, it was filmed on Snapchat, and before the attackers then realized the couple did not match the profile of the people who they were trying to rob, and then they fled. And then on July 17th, this was all like within a month. On July 17th, a third group approached the house, but was reportedly scared away by the alarm that they had installed before they could get inside. So they installed an alarm system after the second time, so I guess they're being proactive there. Oh my God. Two men aged 20 and 21 appeared in court over the third attempted intrusion. One defendant told the court he had accepted a mission through Telegram between 15,000 and 30,000 euros without knowing exactly what it involved. He said he wanted to repay about 4,000 euros in debt linked to his mother, who he said was facing eviction. A second defendant, a rideshare driver, was reportedly paid 300 euros to drive the group from the Paris region to the victims. The group carried a crowbar and cable ties, etc. The third attempt triggered an investigation by the police. Investigators examined footage and telephone records and found DNA evidence on the toll ticket from the motorway. Why were they not able to get the Snapchat people? They were fucking on Snapchat. Can't they just subpoena them? Whatever. Anyway, you guys get the idea, though. And I mean, I've been reading stories like this throughout the past year. There was one where they were like cutting off fingers of people until they would give them a password and shit. In this situation, they don't even have the crypto. They just moved in. It's kind of funny, though. I'll be honest. It is kind of hilarious that this happened three times in a month. Like, that's fucking insane. It's like swatting almost. Anyways, so that, like, this is a huge issue with, you know, safety, privacy, and it really opens the door to another reason why I don't really like hardware wallets, because you're putting trust into a company. So not only are you trusting that they make the product correctly, but you're trusting that they handle your information correctly. And as we're going to see now, Trezor and SafePal, they didn't do this correctly, and they were both exploited. So this is Trezor. This is their statement they put out. We have some difficult news to share. Unfortunately, one of our shipping providers has experienced a data breach that exposed sensitive order data. This affects new customers in the United States, United Kingdom, Sweden, Colombia, Brazil, Italy, and Portugal who received an order within the 90 days prior to August 8th, 2026. The data that has been exposed: full names, shipping addresses, phone numbers, email addresses. The incident affects 11,742 customers with full exposure, which is the data I just mentioned, and 1,947 customers with partial exposure, which is just name, city, and email. The breach is limited due to Trezor's strict 90-day storage policy. We were able to negotiate the same terms with fulfillment partners who follow the same policy. All affected customers have been contacted separately by email. Our systems and devices remain secure, but affected customers could experience an increase in phishing attempts. Never enter your wallet backup on a website or share it with anyone, and only check for updates on official Trezor channels. We're deeply sorry to the community and those affected. We are investigating the situation and will post updates on our blog. So, yeah, in addition to wrench attacks, which are obviously the most, you know, violent physically, you also have phishing, obviously. That's going to be going on. So these people are going to be receiving a ton of emails. They're going to be receiving calls, you know. Yeah, but this whole fishing operation, I mean, it is quite lucrative. You know, you only need to get one hit out of a week. And I mean, you know, so you're going to imagine that there's going to be a bunch of different attempts, and we're probably going to be hearing stories either of phishing or, you know, of actual attacks because of this information. But one thing I want to point out here, though, is that this actually wasn't directly caused by Trezor, but it was caused by their shipping provider. ShipMonk is the logistics partner that stores our products and ships orders to customers in the United States, UK, and several other countries to deliver a parcel. They need your name, shipping address, phone number, and email address. That's why they hold your data, and they have to delete it or anonymize it within 90 days after delivery. And that's kind of the thing, like, because not only are you trusting Trezor, though, you're trusting the companies that they're also using. And, like, obviously your shipping provider, you want to hope that they have good security. And in this case, they didn't. So when you buy a hardware wallet, it's not even just the company that you're buying it from, but it's logistically also the shipping provider and the manufacturer of the hardware wallet. And there's like all these different like things that can happen in the process that can impact you. And this is why, you know, I talked about this recently, a couple episodes ago. I think the best way to make a cold storage wallet is just making a new wallet and then just writing it down. It takes 2 seconds. It's free and it works. I think people get kind of crazy when it comes to these hardware wallets. If you do end up buying one, I would advise, you know, going, I mean, Trezor is the best option, which is the worst part about this. Cause their, actual, you know, products have always worked pretty well from what I understand. But you know, if you do buy it in person or at some event, so your information isn't lying around, I don't know. Because this is obviously one way that you can be targeted. And so is there even any hardware wallets left that haven't been exploited? I think Foundation is one, right? And yeah, I do know Ledger, which is the other popular one. They had this happen to them like a year ago, and that was pretty bad. You know, they did have to deal with a bunch of customers where, you know, moved or had issues, and it's been a shit show. So we're going to be seeing more of that. So that's Trezor. The other one is called SafePal. That's right. Their name is SafePal. Oh, boy. They might as well change their name to Not SafePal. This is the statement they put out. Dear community, while your SafePal wallet, seed phrase, and private keys are secure, we identified a flaw in the order tracking plugin that led to unauthorized access to information of a subset of customers. This issue has been fixed with additional security measures introduced. The incident impacts approximately 39,798 customers who placed orders between March 2nd, 2025 and April 11, 2026. Exposed information includes name, email address, shipping address, phone number, and purchase details. All affected customers have been notified individually by email. We have also published this webpage for people to directly contact them. This incident did not involve your seed phrase, private keys, wallet password, or other wallet credentials, bank account information, payment card numbers, or government-issued identification numbers. Never share your seed phrase, private key, or password with anyone, and stay vigilant against phishing or impersonation attempts. We are extremely sorry to the community and those who are affected. So yeah, this is 4 times as many customers impacted than for Trezor. But still, that's a lot of fucking people. Like, how did this issue... This persisted for well over a year. And that's crazy to me. Yeah, I've never even heard of SafePal, to be completely honest. I'm kind of out of the loop on these different wallets. But, yeah, this is just an absolute disaster. And I'm sure these stories of people getting wrench attacked or fished or whatever will begin trickling in, which is pretty unfortunate. I also here have a brief statement here from Zach Herbert, who is the lead for Foundation. He's the CEO of Foundation, which is a popular Bitcoin wallet, hardware wallet, for cold storage. And he says, regarding Trezor and the shipping providers, this is a difficult issue. I don't know how to handle it for Foundation. Shipping providers are a third-party dependency we just cannot remove. That kind of says it all. Yeah, because even if you have a perfect device and you've checked all the boxes for what you're supposed to do, then they just go and hand it off to another company. And that other company, I mean, they could have absolutely terrible security. So again, when you're trusting a hardware wallet, it's not just the company that you're buying it from. It's also dependencies that they're dealing with. And a shipping provider is probably going to be targeted more than any other type of dependency in crypto, right? Because it has information. Well, that in exchanges, right? Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about Coinbase earlier this year, where they had their customer service people, they had access to all this data, and, you know, they're poor, living in the fucking middle of a crowded slum in India, and they're being offered like thousands of dollars just to give away customer information. And they're like, okay, they'll do that. Yeah, I think that's really, for me, what's most surprising is, like, you would think things would have improved by this point, but it's just like we're just finding more and more issues. And it's pretty clear that all these companies, what they do is they just get your money and then they just put out a statement, oh, we really care about your privacy, you know, we really care and stuff. And it's like, no, I think you just kind of want their money. You know, you name yourself SafePal. You're using privacy as a marketing gimmick. And meanwhile, you have a fucking plugin for over a year that was leaking data about customers. Like, it's just criminal. And then you just put out a statement, well, we really care about our customers and their privacy. I don't think so. I think you probably did not spend any time auditing any of your security. I'd be surprised if you were during this entire time. And I don't know who the fuck you're hiring to do your work, but they're probably not good. And I you know what? I doubt they even care. If we're really being honest, they probably don't even give a shit. Because, you know, this stuff kind of blows over and people will just keep, the grift will continue. I mean, maybe their sales will go down. How much was Ledger impacted? They're still around, right? They're still around. Coinbase is still the most popular exchange. They dealt with their issues. Anyways, that is the hardware wallet shit show going on with Bitcoin. I think you guys get the idea. The only thing I could say, if you're new, is just really try to limit the amount of data you're giving to people. Like, really try to minimize it, because you should just expect that eventually these websites are going to get hacked somehow. Because it's just incompetence everywhere. So, you know, this is why in a lot of my work, I just say don't use KYC. Now, people are still going to use it, and that's fine. I don't really care, but just know what you're giving away when you're using an exchange. Because if, for example, all that information would be public knowledge, or at least on the darknet, on your account, all your purchases, the wallet addresses, your address, if that all was on the internet right now, would you be concerned? This is how you should be thinking. And I'm not saying that all of these exchanges are going to get hacked. It's like an inevitability. I'm not saying that, but you should think of it that way. Just think of a worst case scenario, because for a hardware wallet, this is obviously very severe. Especially like if you think of like the Trezor one too, it's within the past 90 days. So people are definitely just put crypto on there. Like, they're much more likely, you know, and even with the SafePal one over the past year and a month, right? or the past year and a half, I should say. Obviously, they're going to have a ton of information on people who probably have crypto stored on these wallets. So it's just absolutely targets for phishing and rent attacks, and not good. All right, so let's shift gears here to our second featured story today. It's not really a story. It's a book review. That's right. I'm reviewing The Reign of Botnets by David Senecal, Defending Against Abuses, Bots, and Fraud on the Internet. Now, the reason I bought this a book, it's about 220-something pages, short read, a lot of diagrams, which I like. A lot of charts, flow chart stuff, pictures and stuff. And the reason I bought this is because I am doing an interview that should be out next week at some point. And the discussion is going to be primarily about botnets and things of that nature. And there'll be other discussions points as well, but this is one of the main drivers of it. And I understand what botnets are and how they work, but I kind of wanted some more knowledge on it. And so anyways, I did a little research and I found this book. I think I found it on Amazon. And it's relatively new. It came out 2 years ago. And basically it is a nice resource, a fantastic resource, really. And if you are a novice on this subject or on the intermediate side, you're probably going to get a lot of information here that you didn't know about. You're going to learn a lot. And on that alone, I would recommend it to people if you're kind of interested in understanding the concepts of not only botnets and what they attack, but also how you can actually discover that you're being attacked. Because this guy, Mr. Senecal here, he is a veteran bot and fraud detection expert. And so a lot of this book, well, the last couple chapters are about actually putting up a defense against these sorts of situations. And he starts off, the first chapter is kind of just a summary of like what a botnet is and like the history of the internet. Basic stuff, but well-written, concise. And because it was released only like a year or two ago, it's still very much relevant information, what he's talking about. It starts to get interesting, though, in chapter two, because he talks about the actual common attacks for botnets. And this is where it gets interesting, right? You have data harvesting, credential harvesting, account takeovers, targeted account takeover attacks, and credential stuffing. These are all different ways that you can get information and then sell that information. And it's pretty eye-opening, like how much stuff can occur. Like you also have web scraping, right? You have scalping events, like hype events. You know, he talks a lot about like, you know, like sneaker sales, and that it's very, you'll make a ton of money if you have a botnet that is just targeting these sneakers. You can then sell with a huge and get huge margins on something like that. You're able to successfully order a bunch of these fucking sneakers. I never got that, by the way, the whole sneaker thing. I never got the whole sneaker thing, but it's a cash cow, evidently. And also carding attacks as well. Spamming. You could spam. Maybe, you can troll people. You can, take over a website, basically. We have the Reddit example is probably the best example of like how bots control that website through voting algorithms and stuff. He has these a few diagrams showing the amount of bots on different types of websites. So for a sportswear company, and these are percentages, 77% of the activity or the traffic on a sportswear website are bot scrapers. Only 5.3% are quote unquote good bots, and 17% are humans. that's how much traffic a website like that is getting. Now, a good bot, so basically like companies they use bots actually to improve their services in different ways. And that's how you have like search engines, find information around on the internet. They use scrapers to like do that. And you also have like, travel services. They scrape data around and try to help you get the cheapest thing you can get, etc. So that was just one example of like a certain type of website. Maybe they're a website, they have like a big like upcoming release, so it's getting a lot of traffic because, you know, bots are, you know, controlling all these different accounts. They're just, you know, trying to buy it as quickly as possible, etc. But in general, he says that the typical traffic distribution of a website on average is 30% human, 27% good bots, and 42% scrapers. And as an aside too, the reason he's just going over scraping activity is because that says, quote, out of all the use cases where bots are used, scraping represents by far the highest volume of traffic. Where a credential stuffing attack can amount to a few hundred thousand requests per day on a website, scraping activity typically results in millions of requests per day. This is why I chose to quantify how much internet traffic comes from bots by looking at the scraping activity. The bot-to-human traffic ratio varies depending on who you ask. In truth, nobody knows because nobody can monitor the whole internet and run bot detection on it. Even if one could run bot detection on 100% of the internet, it also assumes that the detection is 100% accurate, which is challenging despite everyone's best efforts in the web security industry. Lastly, bot activity comes and goes. Today's scraping traffic may not be the same as tomorrow. And like the other attacks too, like that you can use with botnets, like credential stuffing. That means basically like taking a username and password and like trying to break into accounts. And then once you break in, you then can sell it. Yeah. You also have opening account abuse, you know, with like banks, for example, you know, so creating fake accounts and doing this to eventually, you know, coincide with some fraud scheme that they're doing, and spamming stuff. I already talked about that. So yeah, a lot of information here about the different types of attacks with examples. And there's also these like diagrams showing how this all is like the circular economy on the darknet with people, you know, at every step of the way, trying to make money, selling your data. And it's pretty wild. Now, when it comes to traffic, so then it gets into, you know, how you can actually tell if, you know, your website's being attacked by bots, right? Even though bots are everywhere anyways. So then there's this concept of the circadian rhythm. That actually is one way you can tell because, you know, your traffic should go up during the day and goes down during nighttime, right? So then if you're seeing like a huge spike of activity 24/7, then something's happening. Something's not right. So that's pretty obvious. Another way is the HTTP headers. And so this was pretty interesting where, you know, when you visit a website, that website already knows information about your computer just based on you visiting it. It knows the browser that you're running, the version of that browser you're running, the operating system you're running. You know, there's the language that you're using, right? These like different like little things, and of course then there's JavaScript, which gets even more intricate. With JavaScript, they'll know, they can like track your mouse movements, literally. So it's a lot. There's like a ton of different ways that a website can get information on you, even if they don't know exactly who you are. And this is you know, probably one of the main reasons I think people get into learning about privacy, because it just seems like it's everywhere. Like information is just being like harvested from you. And even in the case of websites where they're doing it to prevent bot activity, the irony is that it's also impacting our rights as the consumer, right? Because the data they're collecting, I mean, I don't want them to have that data, right? But they're doing it to help you in a way because they don't want their website to be overrun with bots. So it's kind of an unfortunate situation. It's also kind of ironic, I think, that they're doing a good, but it's also making things worse, I guess. And so anyways, with the HTTP headers, basically a lot of the botnets give away information about themselves and the attack that's going on because their headers are just illogical. For example, he mentions if you have an outdated version of Windows running, probably a botnet, especially if you're getting a lot of traffic from like an old version of Windows, right? That should be a dead giveaway. Why are there so many people suddenly visiting my website from, you know, some fucking Windows operating system that's like a decade old, right? Or if you're getting a lot of traffic from like China and the language is listed as English, for example, that should raise some eyebrows. So basic stuff like that. But obviously botnets have become, you know, more advanced over time, obviously. And so they've done the best that they can to, fight back. So it's like a cat and mouse game being played, essentially. So then he talks about the six stages of botnet evolution. And I like this part because it kind of details this cat and mouse game that I mentioned, right? So he says that stage one is deploying the botnet on a handful of nodes, running a simple script. So very basic. You know, you're not really doing that much from the botnet perspective. And they're probably being pretty lazy with how it's going on because it's just like a simple script. Stage two is the botnet grows in size and they impersonate their headers more advanced, right? They put in more effort into blending in. Stage three, reverse engineering JavaScript and replay fingerprints. So one of the ways to stop a botnet, right, is CAPTCHAs. And, you know, what you can do is you can actually, like, if the CAPTCHA is, like, requires you to move your mouse around, you'll actually, with JavaScript, be able to, figure out if someone's, like, a human or not, just based on how their mouse moves. And so what the botnet's going to try to do is they're going to try to program their botnet to behave like a human. So the mouse moves like a human or something. It's wild stuff. So then they start doing that. At this point, it's obviously much more difficult for the botnet to succeed. So then they move on to basically DDoSing. In stage four, they force the web security product to fail open. And by that, he means, this is from the book, failing to defeat the detection through replay, the most persistent attackers will try to send malformed data to see if it triggers some exceptions. After all, bot operators are all developers, and they know that software exceptions can cause the product to fail safe or fail open. In effect, this means that tripping an exception or a bug in the product forces a bypass of the defenses. They also know that detection engines don't have infinite capacity, and the fail-safe mechanisms may trigger if overwhelmed with traffic. Bot developers are the best quality assurance engineers out there. Yeah, pretty much. And then moving on, stage five, they upgrade the botnet to a headless browser. So just making it even harder to detect. You know, they're also diversifying their IP addresses, making it harder to see where traffic is coming from. It just looks like regular people. And then finally, stage six, resort to a human/manual attack. I mean, this is just more advanced. It's going to be a lot slower at this point because their bots are pretty much ineffective. And so, you know, switching up their attacking scheme might be more profitable in that case. Now, regarding CAPTCHAs too, CAPTCHAs suck ass. And he talks about why CAPTCHAs suck, but also why they're good. And then you can also basically farm humans to solve CAPTCHAs. Like, you've seen those videos with the Chinese kid with like all the phones. That actually is a thing, believe it or not. Like, they make, I forgot how much they make per CAPTCHA. It's only like 3 cents or something like that. Might even be less. Yeah, right here it says, on average, they get paid $1 per 1,000 CAPTCHAs solved. The earnings vary depending on the difficulty of the CAPTCHA. And yeah, he talks about the different types of CAPTCHAs too and why. You know, you're trying to, like, make it hard for botnets, but also you don't want to piss people off. Which I've never thought about that, but that's kind of true. So anyways, I look at CAPTCHAs a little differently now that I've read this stuff. So yeah, the second half of the book kind of takes the knowledge of like how to detect it and then forming strategies to then appropriately deal with bots. Because you have to think too, you don't want to stop the good bots. For example, if you're appearing on a search engine, you want those scrapers to like access your platform, right? Because like you want that exposure. So it's like you want to like make sure keeping the good bots prevented the bad bots. And there's a whole game that you have to play, you know, regarding that. So you have like risk scores, things of that nature. Very interesting stuff. The last chapter is about privacy, how obviously it's an issue and they're trying to work on that. Anyways, I really enjoyed it. Probably if you're advanced, you already know all this information, but I learned a lot and it's an easy read. So I'll leave a link down below if you're interested. I say check it out. With that out of the way, let's get to our sponsors real quick and then we will take a few more stories and then get out of here. First up, we got OrangeFriend.com. OrangeFriend is our good old pals who are the kings of MoneroCon now that they are running MoneroCon for next year as well. And they're just great community members. I really enjoy their service quite a bit. It's a directory to find all things Monero, as well as to find appropriate coin swaps that fit your needs. So go to orangefriend.com and use their services today. Next up, we got Monero.forum. Oh, yeah. Monero.forum is where I post and where other people post as well. You can go there, make threads, talk about Monero, talk about music, whatever you want to talk about. It's a forum, okay? It's not like some whack-ass, social media stuff. Back to the boomer days. Is whack a boomer term? Damn it. I'm morphing into a boomer. It's really bad. Anyway, go to Monero.forum. Yeah, Monero.forum right now. Okay, next up, we got Unstoppable.money. Yeah, the Unstoppable wallet is quite popular within the crypto industry, especially within for Monero users because it's non-custodial, and they take privacy pretty seriously. But of course, we don't just trust them because they say that. It's an open source wallet, though. And they are definitely of the more trusted wallets out there. They're also not selling any hardware wallet. But anyways, you can make a wallet and you can also use their swap service at swap.unstoppable.money. Just be mindful of the metadata that you're leaving around when you do use that swap service. And next up, we got MyNimbox. Yeah, MyNimbox.io. This is just a really useful service because you can get a server and a web domain with Monero. That's the advertisement. How fucking awesome is that? My website, antimoonboy.com, uses my Nimbox. So I've been using their service for a while. I reached out to them, said, hey, I like your service. Want to be on my show? And they said, hell yeah. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. MyNimbox.io, highly recommend for anyone who is looking to get their feet wet, running a server. Maybe you want to try out making a website, use their service. Last but not least, we got WebWipe. That's right, WebWipe.io. And while they're wiping you down, getting all that data you have on the internet off the internet, which is great. I mean, that's basically what we've been talking about the entire episode, right? They also are experts at wallet recovery. So listen, if you have a wallet, you lost half your seed phrase or whatever, you don't know what to do, go to the guys over at WebWipe because they got these programs that they run. They'll be able to recover that cryptocurrency that you lost. So go to webwipe.io today. Okay, we got a few little tidbits to get to, and then we're going to get the heck out of here. And our first story is from The Rage. And this is the headline. Get ready for this one. Chainalysis Government Solutions sues United States and Federal Claims Court. Yeah. The court has placed filings under protective order, finding that certain information likely to be disclosed orally or in writing during the course of this litigation may be competition sensitive. TRM Labs, one of Chainalysis's main competitors, appears as voluntary co-defendant on behalf of the United States. Federal Claims Court handles nationwide claims against the United States government, often involving contract disputes and bid protests. Womp, womp, womp. Yeah, so it seems like Chainalysis is again cucked by TRM Labs, and that's kind of funny. Yeah, this was that was their stomping ground for a while. Chainalysis, they were just running the show there. They convinced all the boomers running this country to pay them these absurd amounts of money to not effectively trace people. And now you got TRM Labs coming into their territory. You know, for whatever reason, I just I don't know why, I just thought of that Breaking Bad. You know, stay out of my territory. Like they're having like a meetup, like in the fucking middle of the Albuquerque desert. Just like, hey, man, we're the ones who are lying in courts, okay? We're the ones doing this grift, okay? Obviously, Chain Analytics is a fraud. Obviously, we're just talking out of our ass. You know and we know it, but stay out of my fucking territory. And the guy from TRM Labs is like, hey, listen, you guys had your moment in the limelight, okay? It's our turn now, okay? It's our turn. We're on Elizabeth Warren's side, okay? You're old news. I don't know. So that was that story. I don't know what the fuck's going on. I don't really care. I just thought that was kind of funny. Then we have, oh yeah, this was a weird one. Bolts. So we talked about this last week. Where Bolts kind of just suddenly just announced that, hey, we're not going to be allowing Lightning Network to work on our service anymore because of AI assisted attackers. Very weird announcement. It got weirder though, because only a couple days ago, they announced that a group of veteran Bitcoiners came forward to help, bringing capital and engineering power the project needs. And they have agreed to take over Bolts and continue the service. Work to find and fix the vulnerabilities is already underway with the goal of bringing swaps back as soon as possible. That's a little suspect. Because basically, this Bolts group, they decided to all resign. It says, they stepped down from the company effective immediately. And then some anonymous group of veteran Bitcoiners now controlling it. Yeah, I don't know. That's a weird one. That is a fucking weird one. Yeah, I think the conspiracy guys are going to love this, and for a good reason, because that just sounds weird. That sounds like some sort of Fed operation. Speaking of law enforcement, I just saw this article. I thought it was disturbing. Here's the headline. Officer arrested after using flock cameras more than 700 times to track his estranged wife. The article requires a subscription to read it, but I do have like a paragraph here. It says that this guy, Christopher Goodson, used a surveillance system between September 1st, 2024 and June 30th, 2026, entering his estranged wife's license plate into the system to track her vehicle. He allegedly used the system 280 times in September 2025 and 104 times in November 2025. When asked the reasoning behind his searches, he cited justifications including assault, battery offenses, drug and narcotics, and criminal motor vehicle offenses. The police department said the wife was not part of any investigation that would have legitimized the searches. So is he just fucking plugging in whatever and just, fucking, it's a drug search. There's absolutely no guardrails on this thing. Yeah, I mean, it's predictable. Obviously, flock cameras are going to be used for a lot of bad, and this is just another example of it. Yeah, I saw that headline, and I was like, man, this is happening fucking all over the country right now. Like, the stories we're going to get, you know, trickling out are just going to be disturbing, to say the least. So then there was the BIP 1110 thing. So BIP 1110 this past week, they decided to create a hard fork. And they're going to have a new proof of work function for it. And so Peter Todd wrote about this. He said that Luke Dash Jr. decided to use a testnet block hash as the random beacon to pick BIP 1110's new proof of work function. An absolutely batshit decision. It's clearly possible to manipulate that by just mining blocks with the right hash. Mining a testnet 4 block has a trivial cost, so mining one with a specific last byte in the block hash, thus forcing a particular proof-of-work choice, also has a trivial cost. When Zcash did something similar for a trusted setup, they picked a Bitcoin block in the future. They specified the block hash would be in turn to be rehashed 2 to the 42nd times to ensure that absolutely no one would be could possibly pick the value in advance. That's which it would take 2 to 3 weeks of sequential computation. Yeah, and so like, anyway, the one thing I want to say about this BIP110 thing, because I talked about him a lot last week, it's a fucking clown show. I told you guys this was going to happen. They have no fucking plan, okay? They're all just on Luke Dash Jr.'s nuts, and this guy is, he's crazy, honestly. So they're like planning this all on Discord, I guess. And he's like making polls and people voting on them. And this is how they're doing their project. It's going to be a complete failure is really what it is. And I got to say too, like, if you really think about it, this whole thing with BIP110, when they eventually hard fork, nobody is going to fucking use this coin. It's going to be a failure on day one. They're going to have such little transactions. Whatever value of this coin is going to be, it's going to plummet. And it's going to be comedy. It's going to be peak comedy because you're going to be having essentially this fork coin that nobody's going to use. And they're going to see how little their network is going to be used compared to Monero. And we're going to make fun of them, man. Oh, because you got to think, like, these Bitcoin podcasters are so up their own ass, all these guys, and they've talked so much shit on Monero. So watching their shitty hard fork fail, it's going to be absolute music to my ears. Can't wait. That's going to be fun. Speaking of Peter Todd, too, this is the last thing I'm going to say before we get to the Super Chats. This week, I think he gave a speech or something on tail emission, because I saw a bunch of people talking about tail emission online and talking about whether it's a good idea or not. And obviously, a lot of the Bitcoiners are completely against this. And so, to be fair, it is usually a bad idea to change the emission schedule after you already created it. It's that you'll lose trust in that regard. So they're kind of stuck, I think. Especially they're stuck now because it has been a while. And then early on, they didn't think this might be a good idea. So it is kind of set in stone at this point. But to be clear to people, though, it's like tail emission. It's not this like infinite supply that people say. Like, this is one of the most common misunderstandings that I see about tail emission, where people are just like, they're just going to print an infinite amount of the cryptocurrency. It's and they think of like the Federal Reserve and central banking. And it's like, no, it's not that at all. It's a diminishing tail emission. It will only ever be 0.6 XMR per block. And this just rewards the mining network. It replaces lost coins. And that's it. It's a small planned inflation. That's it. And, you know, right now, I believe Monero's yearly emission is actually below Bitcoin's. It won't be that much longer, though, but I digress. There will be less Monero than Bitcoin until 2040. So, like, this is, like, way, way exaggerated by people who just don't understand how inflation should work, right? Like, gold has a yearly inflation, but you don't really think of it that way. Another thing, too, though, is the actual tactical arguments of it. I don't think the Bitcoiners understand this at all. Because, like, as that block reward goes down, if you want the Bitcoin price to continue going up, they're going to have to, like, jack up transaction fees. Like, a lot. And it just turns into the situation where people won't even be able to move their cryptocurrency, or in this case, their Bitcoin. And they won't be able to move it because the transaction fees will be too high, because the the miners, they're getting less of a reward, so they need to somehow make something. And yeah, that's pretty much it. So, you know, there's this idea that, well, we'll just move on to the second layer. It's like, okay, how are you going to move on to the second layer? You're going to have to spend Bitcoin to move on to it. And that's going to be really hard because you have to make a transaction to do that. So that's well in the future. I don't know how long, actually. This could start to become a bigger issue after the next halving. And that's the thing. If we see diminishing returns, it's going to be harder and harder to justify not having something like tail emission. And it seems like the Bitcoiners have well decided that they're against it. The only other thing I would say, though, is that miners might be more supportive of tail emission. If you really think about it, because they want to get paid more. And it would actually help the chain out. But many Bitcoiners are just not willing to have this discussion, and it's probably not going to happen anyways. All right, so let's get to the Super Chats, xmrchat.com/Xenu. We got one this week. This is from Shortwave Surfer 2009. He gives 0.01 XMR. Thank you. And he says, check out XMR Pod, the creators of XMR Chat. It's an antenna pod fork that lets you send Monero tips directly from the player screen. Well, thank you very much, Shortwave Surfer. I did check it out just briefly. And yeah, if you go to look up Anti-Moonboy, it has like a little Monero logo, and you can then send Monero that way. I thought that was pretty cool. And yeah, I imagine like over time they're going to make it. Right now, it just seems like a direct fork for the most part, but it'd be cool if they had like a page for Monero podcast. Like that's what you hit when you open it or something. You can just see the Monero Jason podcast. We could start to build like a nice community through that. I think it's a great idea. So check that out. You can find that on GitHub. It is Android only though. But thought that was pretty cool. Okay, we're at the end of the episode and... Oh no. Not again. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like we are being visited by Steve the Alien again. Hello, hello, hello. I am so happy to be back, and I have seen all the comments on the internet begging for me to return. Actually, there were zero comments saying they wanted you back on the show. Literally zero. However, the people have been seeing me everywhere because aliens are all over the news. Lots of UFOs. Many, many, many UFOs. We're going to be taking over the world soon. Yeah, that's the other thing, too. I think you guys are kind of milking this a little too long. Just like, you know, take over the world at some point. We really are kind of over the UFO thing, to be honest with you. Soon the Xenu Knights will take over the world and force people to listen to Anti-Moonboy news. What the hell is a Xenu Knight? Well, you see, I am from the planet Xenu. I am a Xenu Knight because everybody on our planet, the millions and billions of aliens, we all listen to your podcast all at the same time and talk about how much we like it. Oh, God, that's super creepy.
Beboop. To be honest, he's kind of growing on me. Beboop.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't really know if I like that there's a lot of aliens who listen to my show on the planet Xenu, which evidently you renamed your planet at some point.
Yes, it was a unanimous decision in our government. We love Anti-Moonboy news.
Yeah, I picked up on that.
And you should come visit sometime.
No, I'm not going to come visit.
But we have many different robot companions that you can see. We are mass producing them.
Oh, well, that sounds kind of interesting. Maybe we'll get together sometime and do that.
Beboop. You are a degenerate Xenu. Beboop.
Whatever. Well, we got to wrap the show up anyway. So thanks to all listening. This is Anti-Moonboy News. You can check out all my stuff on antimoonboy.com. I'm going to go now. See ya.